This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Father Jeff Bai, 34 years a Catholic priest in this diocese. He has some ideas to share regarding the abrupt resignation of Pope Benedict. Also, Gus Weil, the fabled political consultant on last night's State of the Union address as President Obama began his second term. The president's in North Carolina today, making his pitch for many of the ideas he conveyed last night before Congress. We'll talk with Gus Weil about this. And Rachel Hebert, she is the executive director for the Sexual Trauma and Awareness and Response Center here in Baton Rouge, and is here to talk about her organization and the 1 Billion Rising event, which is taking place nationwide. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. Please call 877-217-5757. We are reachable via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org throughout the show. And our guest to begin is Father Jeff Bai. 34 years he has been a priest in this diocese, the Diocese of Baton Rouge. That's most of his life, and this is an eventful week for the Roman Catholic Church with the abrupt resignation of Pope Benedict XVI. He announced Monday he will resign at the end of the month, February 28th, the first pontiff to do so in nearly 600 years, and the decision sets the stage for a conclave to elect a new pope before the end of March. Good morning, Father Bai.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
What is your assessment of what is going on in Rome?
You know, Jim, the question of the Pope's retirement and failing health has been bannered about for a number of years now, at least 2 years. You know, talking about the possibility, if he does, if he will, that sort of thing. You got to realize that he was 20 years older than John Paul II when he was elected pope. John Paul II was elected pope at the age of 58. Cardinal Ratzinger became Pope Benedict XVI at age 78. He had already approached John Paul II about retiring as a cardinal when John Paul had died, and he was elected pope. And he's soon to be 86 on April 16th, and my mother's 86 years old, Jim, and thank God she's still here and everything. And I just look at my mom and the struggles that she has on a daily basis, and thinking about the Pope and everything that he has to do worldwide, and it's just, it's an incredible reality that he's still around. So in one sense, you know, I'm not surprised. It's been bannered about, and knowing the type of integrity that Pope Benedict has brought to the chair of Peter is—it's really not a surprise. I just suspect, and this is, you know, simply the priest from Zachary's suspicion that probably once a new pope is elected, there's probably been a health incident that has precipitated it being as abrupt as it was, but I think it's been coming for a while.
Well, this is Ash Wednesday, of course, and this is happening right in the midst of the holy season. Will there be a new pope by Easter?
Oh, I would venture to say that the conclave begins, you know, immediately following. I think we will, within 5 or 6 days of the beginning of the conclave, I think we will have a new pope.
Any thoughts about where the new pope will come from? Will it be an American? Is that possible?
Well, you know, I'm just, and here again, you got to realize I'm not an outsider. I just hear things like everyone else hears things. But there's always been a sort of thing that a first world pope, if you will, is probably not in the offing. But I would think Timothy Cardinal Dolan, who is Cardinal Archbishop of New York, probably has as great a prominence and as great a respect as any American has ever had going into a conclave. And, you know, as to whether or not he will emerge as Pope, I pretty much subscribe to the school of thought that we're probably not ready for an American Pope. And I think in the emerging world, within, the Spanish-speaking population and a lot of that third world country, I think that's a real possibility. There was a young cardinal from the Philippines this last consistory, which I happen to be in Rome for. And, I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but he's the Cardinal Archbishop of Manila. And there was great expectations for this, young cardinal. But, of course, he's only, been in office as a cardinal now for, since November, 3 months. So, I don't know. This is a time I spoke to a good friend of mine in Rome the day this all occurred when, the Italians watch the papacy the way the Brits watch the royal family, okay? And, of course, there's all kind of, speculation about the future pope that they call the papabile.
Mm-hmm.
And, and the reality is that they've never been right yet. I really believe that the Holy Spirit does still guide it. People say, yeah, but there's got to be a lot of politics in that. But since it's only 118 people from around the world who make this decision, and I'm certainly not on the end with any of them, I think that the choices in my lifetime of those chosen to lead the church are a great example of the fact that the Holy Spirit does guide us. And I believe that, and I trust that.
We're visiting with Father Jeff Bai. He's been a priest in the Baton Rouge area for 34 years. You went in the seminary at what age?
I went in the seminary at age 13. I'm one of these socially promoted Catholic school kids. I stayed in Catholic school until they made me a priest, Jim.
13.
Yeah. There was a high school cathedral prep here in Baton Rouge at the time, and I was able to go to high school like the other kids went to Catholic High, the Academy, or Lehigh, or Baton Rouge High, and I was able to go there every day, come home every night. From there, I went to the college seminary in Covington and finished at Notre Dame in New Orleans.
And as priests go, Baton Rouge is a relatively small area on the planet, but Father Bai is perhaps the largest priest I've ever known personally.
Let's don't let size enter into this. I'm not the fattest, Jim, okay? There are some who are heavier than I am.
That's true, but you're how tall?
I'm 6'1".
Yeah, I thought you were a little taller than that, but...
Yeah.
But you're a commanding presence.
And, well, you're very kind, Jim.
And Father Bai knew the previous pope rather well, didn't you?
Well, I was very, very blessed. He had a number of opportunities to be with him privately and personally. And it wasn't like I was on his Christmas card list, but I did have a number of opportunities to be in his presence and speak with him privately, and it was a great blessing, a great gift. It really was.
How does this guy from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, get the inside track to being friends with Pope John Paul and Mother Teresa?
Jim, I laugh. God has been so good to me, and I'm one of these people that they say choose what door. I don't think about that. Get on the other side of the door, and God has always brought me through. And I've just had some really, really incredible opportunities to be in the presence of people that I consider some of the saints of our day.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just a real blessing. And I got to tell you, it was dumb luck. I mean, trust me, I'm not an insider in any way, shape, or form. I guess if I was Jewish, they would call it chutzpah.
Yeah, you get to know people.
And
people in all walks of life at high levels and not so high levels. But as far as the Pope and papal infallibility, some say that's an outmoded concept. What's your response?
Well, You know, Jim, first of all, when people talk about papal infallibility, most of the people don't even know what papal infallibility is. Most people think that papal infallibility means anything this man says is absolutely 100% true. That's not what papal infallibility is. Papal infallibility is clearly defined that when the Pope speaks in matters of faith and morals, and ex cathedra from his chair, just a little tidbit here. You know, we have a cathedral downtown. Well, there's a chair in there that only the bishop sits in as a sign of his authority. So when the Pope speaks ex cathedra from his chair on matters of faith and moral, he speaks infallibly. You know how many infallible statements there are in the history of the Church, Jim? And you're Catholic, so come on, I'm going to put you on the spot.
How many in the history of the Church?
Yeah.
Less than 100.
Two.
Two. And what are those?
1854 and 1954, the Assumption, the Immaculate Conception, that Mary was conceived without sin, and that Mary was assumed into heaven, both body and soul. Those are the only two infallible statements of the Church. And so oftentimes when people think about papal infallibility, if the Pope says it, you know, if he says it looks like rain, everyone in Italy buys an umbrella. That's not what papal infallibility is.
But when the Pope speaks on birth control,
right,
or something like that, is that
that is a papal encyclical, and it came out in Marseille, 1967, in Humanae Vitae, in which the faithful are in good conscience bound to assent to follow. But it's not considered an infallible teaching.
Okay.
It is a held teaching of the Church, but it's not infallible. If something's infallible, then the next Pope can't come along and say, you know, Mary wasn't assumed into heaven, because that's infallible. Mm-hmm. So we need to make that distinction between what Church teaching is and what the faithful are bound to assent to in faith and what the Church considers an infallible teaching.
Well, there is such reverence among many in the Catholic flock for the office of the Pope, if you will, that there's some who believe the Church is a ship without a rudder right now.
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, at age 78, I don't think anyone saw this papacy to go with the length of Pope John Paul II. You know, just simply age and limitations from that. I think he's been a wonderful, wonderful transition and continuing and defining the legacy of Pope John Paul II. You know, and the thing is, and I believe this is part of it, you got to realize that he was tapped, so to speak, by Pope John Paul II to be the head of the Congregation of the Faith. And so he was there, and he saw Pope John Paul II with his Parkinson's and his failing health and with his disease. And I think he pretty much realized that you know, he'd gotten to a point where even though the Pope was still alive, his effectiveness and his ability to govern the Church, probably the last several years of his life, were minimal. And I think he probably, you know, saw that in himself. He didn't want that to happen. He didn't want those around the Pope to be the one who actually made the decisions. He thought that, you know, the Petrine office should be, you know, coming from the Pope. And as he sees himself becoming less and less capable because of health reasons to exercise the ministry, I think it's a great act of humility that he stepped aside and said, you know, we need to let the office be administered by someone who's capable of doing that.
297-5633. We'll take a short break, 90 seconds, and return with Father Jeff Bai. 3.5 decades a priest in the Baton Rouge Diocese. He went in the seminary when he was all of 13 years old. He's commenting on the resignation coming in just 15 days of Pope Benedict XVI, the 265th Pope. announcing that he's leaving because of health reasons. And at 85 years, 318 days, Pope Benedict will have lived longer than all but three of his predecessors. We'll be back with Father Baye. WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 is your number. A bombshell Monday when Pope Benedict XVI at 85 announced that he will leave the papacy at the end of the month, February 28th, and the Catholic Church is in a mode right now trying to select a successor to Pope Benedict, who succeeded the extremely popular Pope John Paul II. Father Jeff Baye is with us from the Diocese of Baton Rouge. Pope Benedict, by the way, is saying that he's looking forward to a leisurely life with his books, his brother, and his beloved cat, a gray cat, by the way. Dan downtown. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air with Jeff Baye, Father Baye. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Father Baye.
Hey, Dan.
Do you believe that Pope Benedict and the Catholic Church has lost credibility because it put the reputation of the institution ahead of the welfare of its constituents, especially young altar boys?
Dan, I think that the incidence of the sexual abuse by clergy members has had a huge, huge impact on the church worldwide. And it's been a great shame that all of us have had to live with. And there is no mistaking the fact that what has happened has been detrimental across the board to, you know, first and foremost to the poor people who've suffered from this type of abuse. The second thing, Dan, is that we are taking what has happened now, and we're applying the standards, the knowledge, the ability to deal with this with current knowledge, and some of these things have happened 40 and 50 years ago. Now, that's not to excuse for 1 minute, Dan, anything that's happened, not to excuse it for 1 minute. But, you know, for instance, I did my residency for my doctorate. I did my residency in the California prison system at a place called Atascadero, and was assigned to MDSO, mentally disordered sex offenders, rapists, and child molesters. And I did this in the mid-70s. And at that point in time, they were still using behavior modification to deal with the problem of child molestation. They didn't know how to deal with it. These guys did X amount of time. They went through therapy. They were released out on the streets. There was no, you know, sex offender registry. There was none of this. And so the idea that at this point in time it looked like a lot of what we were doing was a great cover-up, I can't say none of it was a cover-up. I think a lot of it was done out of ignorance. Because going back to 1975, the only thing they did with people who were convicted of child molestation, and I was, you know, witness to this therapy, they attach electrodes to the offender's genitals. They showed them pictures of pornography, and if they had any state of arousal, they were shocked, and that was supposed to be the way we dealt with it. There were none of the safeguards in place. There was no knowledge of that. You know, that was the same time we were taking alcoholism and giving people anti-abuse or doing, you know, or frontal lobotomies and the shock therapy type of thing. So I can't say for sure, Dan, that, you know, oh, absolutely there was, you know, there was no cover-up. I think there was as much ignorance as there was cover-up as well. But in answer to your question, has that hurt our credibility? I don't think there's any question about it. I don't think there's any question about it. A point that I would make is that we feel the shock of that really, really very painfully in this country, and rightfully so. No question about it. When we talk about the papacy, this is also the one who deals with the number of people who are being killed, you know, on a daily basis in Syria right now. This is also also the one who, you know, deals with the fact that 27% of the African continent is infected with AIDS. It being a universal church, there's just a whole host of issues that we deal with. And one of the very serious ones has been clerical sexual abuse, which is an abomination and, you know, and been done horribly. Was it all done as a cover-up? Some of it could have been. I think, you know, it's fair to say that a certain amount of it was done out of ignorance as well. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't ignorance that was confined to the Catholic Church.
There were over 1 billion Catholics worldwide and over 2 million in the state of Louisiana.
Right.
Baton Rouge is a highly Catholic city. In the United States, Father Bai, hope you'll hold that call, by the way.
I am.
In the United States, polls indicate, and I think you can see it with your own eyes, that most Catholics don't go to church every Sunday. That when I was a kid, that was considered to be a mortal sin not to go to church on Sunday. Is this in some way related to the scandals of the last several years?
You know, Jim, that's a question that is really, really difficult to answer in this sense. I think across the board we have religion in general. You know, when the report comes out, and this came out from NBC News, that 1 in 5 adults now consider themselves non-believers. I think we live in a generation where people being told anything is very, very difficult. I'll give you a prime example that happened here in my own community. We're an old church. We don't have a choir room and that sort of thing. But we have an area for, you know, for a nursery. And one Sunday it was really, really bad. You know, just the whole time. And so simply at the end of Mass, I make announcements. And I announced again, you know, that I want to remind everyone we do have a choir room available. I had people leave the church because I made that announcement. I didn't stop and tell someone, hey, take that crying kid out of here. But just announcing that we had a choir room offended people. I think we deal with that across the board about people who don't want to be told, well, you know what, it's against God's law to live together. It's against God's law for, you know, whatever. You name whatever you're remaining faithful to the teachings of the church and the scriptures, people don't want to hear that. And consequently, they either quit going to church or they go to a church where, you know, it's pretty much we leave everything up to your conscience and we just need to know that God loves you and you love God. And the laws you can kind of interpret for yourself. And I think that's an issue, Jim, that permeates society, and I pretty much think it's across the board. And so I think it's gonna be a difficult time for religion in our country. And then, you know, I gotta say this, Jim, the media does not do much to give anything positive about faith or religion. Perfect case in point. Jim, on Monday, when the Holy Father announced that he would be resigning, and of course things came out, and it, you know, about the first American Pope could be Cardinal Dolan from New York, HBO aired a special about child abuse in the Catholic Church, and they took a case from Milwaukee where Cardinal Dolan was at one time Archbishop, long after they had some serial predator in Milwaukee, and they spent the entire time talking about how poorly he handled everything. Well, Jim, you know, I just think that, well, that just happened to coincide. I don't believe that. I think there is an intentional. There is an intentional affront to organized religion. And I think we as Catholics, or because we're probably the largest religion and probably one of the most directed religion when it comes to, you know, preaching to our people about, you know, the teachings of the church and remain faithful to the scripture. And I think most people would say, as Catholics, you all have more rules than other people. Mm-hmm. True statement. You know, the fact that they came out and did that on that day, I think was intentional, Jim. I really wonder if the Grand Mullah in Iran, if when he died, you know, the Ayatollah, if HBO would air a special talking about, you know, radical Islamic terrorist attacks around the world the same day to coincide with that.
Okay. Well, then I think that's a topic that has legs, and we'll certainly follow the selection of the Pope with you, Father Bai. And thank you for joining us on Ash Wednesday. Did you have Mass this morning?
I did, and I've got two more. Three more for the day. So
three more. And where will you be Sunday?
Sunday I will be here, and then I'm going to be out at Angola.
Well, where is here? Where?
I'm sorry. I'm in St. John the Baptist in Zachary and Our Lady of the Assumption in Clinton. And Sunday we have Sister Breech McKenna coming in to do a parish mission, and we're going to go out to Angola and do something special for the inmates as well out there. That Catholic community out there.
All right. Well, thank you for your service, Father Jeff Bai, and for your time today. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Take care, my
God friend. Bless.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. God bless. And we're joined now by Gus Weil, the fabled political consultant. Good morning to you, Gus.
Good morning, Jim. Father Bai is a bright, bright man.
Yeah, you know him from the LSU basketball years, don't you?
And he's a bright guy.
Yeah, he's a bright guy and a passionate man, and we need passion, don't we? In all walks of life.
Oh, my God.
Last night, the president gave a passionate address to the American people. Gus Weil, you were absorbing and taking in what the president had to say. He called for a rising, thriving middle class. What's your take?
Well, as somebody of the middle class, I liked it. Let me tell you what I think. As I observe Obama as a candidate, an elected president, and then reelected president, I think that not while he's in office, but later in our history, he will be recognized as one of the great humanitarian presidents in American history. I think he's that great a man. His caring about people, about the voiceless, about people who minimum wage isn't going to cut it for their families, about children not being able to get Head Start in their schools. I think that that is so very telling, and I think it's telling in the finest way. In other words, I think Obama is a great man.
Well, last night after the address, U.S. Senator David Vitter released this statement. He says, on the positive side, I think President Obama focused on the right central theme, creating jobs. That's probably because we actually had negative economic growth last quarter with unemployment still around 8%. But I think everything he's talking about is the same old, more government programs and investment, code word for spending. There are a lot of important things we can do that don't involve that, including producing great energy jobs right here in America. If we just get the federal government out of the way and allow Americans to produce more American energy, there can be great high-paying jobs to really boost the economy, says Junior Senator David Bruce Vitter. Your reaction, Gus Weil?
Vitter's going to run for governor of Louisiana. They're obviously grooming him, and he is about ready for that attempt. I think he would be a horrible governor, and if it's possible, I think he would be to the right of our present governor. He's against any government helping anybody. Government is evil. Big government is particularly evil.
Well, I'm not sure that I would totally agree with the remarks you made about that, but there's no doubt that he rails against government, as does our current governor. Here's David Vitter, who spent, he was in the legislature from 1992 to 2005, the state legislature. He was a congressman from 2005. Well, I take that back. He was in the legislature from 92 to 99, and then he was a congressman from 99 to 2005, a U.S. senator 2005 to the present. So the last 21 years, here's a man who has been fully funded, in lavish style by the taxpayers of Louisiana and of the United States. Is there some disconnect here?
Well, absolutely. Let me ask you a question, and you're truly a student of government. Do you know of one positive accomplishment that this man has made that benefited we the people? I'm not talking about the oil industry or the multimillionaires who give to his campaign, but just ordinary people. You would be unable to come up with anything that he has done.
Well, I am told, and I've never had to deal directly with him on anything like this, but when you call his office for constituent service, he's very good at that. I like the idea that he's trying to get Canadian drugs into the United States at lower costs for people for who need prescriptions. I think that's a great move by the U.S. Senator. When he was in the legislature, he was the man who led the fight for term limits. That may not have been a good thing, but he's the one who made it happen. He blew the lid on the Tulane scholarship scandal. I liked that. I thought that was something that needed to be reviewed by the people of Louisiana. So I think he's done some good things, Gus.
Well, I'll bet you that those few things that you're able to call have cost us in his salary millions. In other words, I think just about anybody who had an opportunity could do it. We'd probably do it for free.
Well, U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, his counterpart, who votes almost directly opposite to Senator Vitter on everything, including most likely the nomination of Chuck Hagel as defense secretary, says, "I think the president's focus on jobs and the economy is exactly where we need to be. While the recession is in our rearview mirror, we still need a lot of work to fully put it behind us. I was glad to hear the president focus on the benefits of natural gas development. This is truly a game changer for our country that's bringing us to the verge of energy independence and has the potential to create millions of good jobs across the country." Now, for those who thought that Senator Landrieu would run away from the president as she seeks re-election next year, it looks like she is embracing the president as she seeks a fourth term in 2014. Gus?
Well, he's a Democrat, and she's a Democrat, and she's going to need all the help she can get from the National Party. And I'll tell you who she's already getting help from, because I've seen her spots running on Louisiana television already extolling her virtues, and that's a chemical industry. They're paying for those spots.
Well, she is somebody who has been on the fence many times. She is in a conservative state. She knows that. So she tries to bridge the gap between the conservative majority in Louisiana and representing an area that is the most liberal part of the state. New Orleans is where she is from.
Increasingly less, though, yeah.
Well, it's a difficult balancing act, isn't it?
Yes, and she's walked that tightrope very well, and I have nothing but admiration for that attribute. She's done a fine job in walking the tightrope. But her, she's been of help, too, in getting money for the state when tragedy has struck, which has been a part of our history. And I just don't think she's been an outstanding senator. She wouldn't be in a class of some of the great senators we've had.
We'll be back with Gus Weil after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Gus Weil is with us, and we'll be visited by Rachel Hebert, Executive Director of the Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response Center, in just a bit. A few more minutes with Gus. If you would like to reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with Gus. Good morning to you.
Good morning, gentlemen, and good morning, Gus. I have to say, Gus, I just appreciate your career and your accomplishments in the political arena. My questions to you are these. As far as the Democratic Party here in Louisiana, what would you advise in terms of taking back some of the seats here? It's such a supposed to be a red state, but I do note that East Baton Rouge Parish and Orleans Parish did vote for the president when they had more votes for the president in those parishes. And the other question is,
all right,
Jim,
I don't know.
I know that we have a very troubled Democratic Party. I saw it die a slow death, and I attributed it to the advent of the oil industry in Louisiana, which brought in Republican influence, which has increased. Our state has become more and more conservative. We probably have the most conservative governor in America. I don't know. Maybe if we can get some good guys to stay in the Democratic Party and run for office rather than do something notable and switch to the Republican Party, as we have seen so many do.
What do you think of these party switchers, Gus?
Well, I think they're awfully practical-minded people. I think that they know that there's no great future in the Democratic Party in Louisiana at this time. If we ever produce a John McKithen, and he's an open Democrat, then I think we can regain at least the governor's office. But right now, I don't even see anybody on the Democratic horizon. Honestly, I wish I could say differently.
But getting back to Phil's remarks, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Shreveport, all these cities, the big cities in Louisiana, voted for the president. Gave him a majority in the last election, although he only got 41% statewide. Look over to Oklahoma. Mitt Romney carried every county in the state of Oklahoma. So we're not as red as some other states.
Well, you can't judge it by Obama, the president, and I'll tell you why. So much of that Obama vote in this state was a black vote who voted for Obama. You really can't judge it much beyond that. You had some Democrats who voted for him, of course, but mostly a black vote.
Well, as Mary Landrieu gears up for a re-election bid next year, she's the only Democrat statewide elected right now. 20 years ago, almost all the elected officials statewide were Democrats. In fact, other than Fox McKithen, your client, every one of them was a Democrat. What the heck happened in the last 20 years?
What happened was, I really do think that I attribute Louisiana's going Republican to the strength of the oil industry in Louisiana. When they, for example, Lafayette, where I come from, where I originated, used to be solidly Democrat. Then the oil center opened in Lafayette, which brought in thousands of people in that industry and good payrolls in that industry. And suddenly, we were going more conservative, much more conservative. For example, when I was a boy, the most powerful person in Lafayette was not a political office holder, but was the bishop by the dominance of the Catholic Church in Lafayette. But then when the oil industry came in, Lafayette became more of a Protestant community and more of a Republican community.
All right, 297-5633, a few more minutes with Gus Weil, the political consultant who was the mentor to the likes of James Carville and Raymond Strother and Roy Fletcher. Charles on North Foster, good morning, my friend. Charles, you're on the air with Gus.
Good morning, gentlemen. Gus, I guess I kind of disagree with you about the oil industry thing because, again, if you look at what the president did after the spill in the Gulf compared to what Exxon got away with doing in Alaska, who would support the oil industry? My point is, and my question to you would be, the Democratic Party seems to have conceded so much of the young vote, so many of the traditional Democratic voters. There's no organized voter registration drive of any sort that I know of. It seems like the guys have just rolled over and played dead, and it wasn't so long that Kathleen Blanco, a Democratic governor, was in the governor's mansion. So I think it's a little bit more practical than that, Gus. I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, the Democrats have a new constituency that we haven't noticed because of Louisiana. It's the Hispanic vote. That may well return the many political offices to the Democratic label, particularly if the, I believe that the immigration bill, I believe Obama is going to successfully get that passed. I also think he'll get gun control passed. But the Hispanic people, who in many states are becoming the numerical dominant, I believe that if you get enough of them in Louisiana and couple them with the black vote and the handful of Democrats like me who still exist, I think that the Democrats can make a comeback.
Okay, finally, I heard you say you thought the president would get the gun vote he needs in Congress. I think there are many skeptics along those lines, Gus. What do you think about...
Yeah, I predict two victories for the president. I predict that he will pass his immigration reform, and I predict that we will have a form of gun control that does not in any way impinge upon the Second Amendment. Everybody who wants a gun will have a gun unless they've got a record and should not have a gun. I think he'll be successful in both of those areas, though.
All right, Dorothy on Goodwood, please be brief. Dorothy, you're on with Gus.
Good morning, Gus. I wanted to point out that I'm a member of the Greater Baton Rouge Women Democrats, and we have a huge membership and a great following, and I don't think the Democrats have rolled over and played dead yet. We have a soiree coming up on the 22nd, and we have a national speaker coming in.
All right. She says the Democratic Party...
Yeah, I never said they rolled over and played dead. One of the callers did, but I never made that assertion.
Okay. Well, Gus, it's always nice to talk with you. And
it's always a pleasure, my friend.
I'm glad you're back in Louisiana. And Gus Weil, of course, next month will turn 80 years old. Hopefully we will spend some time with him around his birthday. We're joined now by Rachel Hebert, Executive Director of the Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response Center. And yesterday, U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, along with others, praised the Senate's passage of the Violence Against Women Act, which she co-sponsored. The bill provides protections for victims of domestic and sexual violence. First enacted in 1994, twice reauthorized by Congress, the Senate passed a nearly identical bill last April, but it was not brought up for a vote in the House. Good morning to you, Rachel Hebert.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
And this dovetails with an event that you're involved with called 1 Billion Rising. This is a worldwide event, isn't it?
It is. It's an international event, women and men in protest of violence against women, so very timely with the passage of VAWA.
And the 1 Billion is the estimated number of women who in their lives will face some kind of violence, whether it's rape or physical assault.
It is. 1 billion,
that's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. A lot of people. A lot of communities being affected. And the 1 Billion Rising event is actually coming at the 15th anniversary of the V-Day, the Vagina Monologues. It was also founded by Eve Ensler, the playwright. So we're here 15 years later saying, wow, still 1 billion women affected, 1 in 3 women raped or beaten.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation. Rachel Hebert is Executive Director of the Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response Center. For those who are unaware, the group has an office here in Baton Rouge on Goodwood Boulevard. What do you do on a regular basis?
So what we provide to the community is we provide hospital advocacy. We provide a 24-hour hotline number, 383-7273. We do group counseling and individual counseling, and all of our services are free and confidential.
And this is something that many folks don't like to talk about. It's an uncomfortable subject, but it's a reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely happens every day in our community.
Is it usually men beating up women?
I would say that most victims are women and most perpetrators are men. So,
why is that the case? Why do you think that is the case?
Why do I think it's the case that...
Why do men, many men, far too many, beat up their partners, associates, whatever, attack people who are much smaller than they, and in some way, I guess, try to assert themselves in a way that is totally unacceptable?
Sure. So I think I can't speak on an individual basis, but I think it certainly points to our culture that likes to commingle violence and sexual activity through the media, through music. So I think that certainly contributes the acceptance of it happening. And then along with that is such a low reporting rate of rape. So we're not holding people accountable when they do commit these crimes.
Well, there's let's say it's a given that most of these incidents, the overwhelming majority, involve men beating up, assaulting women. The men, of course, are totally out of line. There is no excuse for any time, any place, any way of ever touching a woman in a violent way. But why do women refrain in many cases from reporting this?
A lot of times it's from fear. It's probably someone they know that's been assaulting them, whether it's their partner, family member. They could be reliant on that person for economic reasons, could have children with the person. And also there's this fear that they won't be believed by the criminal justice system. Their case won't go anywhere. Lots and lots of reasons why people don't come forward.
But it would seem that perhaps by not reporting it, it encourages more violence.
Absolutely. And they both contribute, because I think there are incidents where, you know, just last year, the Baton Rouge Police Department had less than 100 rapes reported. And we know that a city of this size, it's probably happening to at least three women a day.
Three women a day?
A day.
You're talking about what would be called in the old days date rape, or just full-blown rape?
Rape, sexual assault, absolutely.
Well, rape is rape, there's no doubt. But if it's somebody you know or somebody you're in a relationship with, it's somewhat distinct from a case in which somebody is raped on the street. But
right.
You're saying most of the time when it happens behind closed doors with somebody you know, it's not reported? If they're three a day,
reported.
Then we know it's not reported.
Right. And it's very complicated.
So what do you do when these people come to you?
So we try to get people into STAR, and of course, reporting rape is not a prerequisite for our services. When they come in, we try to work on recovery. So while we always hope that people and encourage people to report, we also understand why it's complicated and they might not want to report. So we do counseling. We do case management. We try to get them connected to other community resources.
Mm-hmm. Is it quite often people who are married or in a relationship, or what's the usual case,
sure.
if there is one, if there's a tradition or a common element to this?
So most commonly, I'd say people are assaulted by someone they know, and it's usually either an acquaintance or a dating partner. At least that's what we're seeing come forward at STAR. But the population that's most vulnerable to assault is children under the age of 18, unfortunately. So when we see that, it's especially devastating.
Children who are female, children who are...
Female and male.
Assaulted generally by the father?
It's generally, we're seeing a lot of cousins, other family members who might also be under the age of 18. It could be a family friend, a trusted coach, someone at school.
Well, sure. The Penn State incident.
Absolutely.
Is a common example of something that is happening, I'm sure, in more places than Happy Valley. But
exactly.
But tomorrow, the 1 Billion Rising event will be in Baton Rouge at the Red Shoes, right?
It will actually be at the North Boulevard Town Square,
okay,
in
well,
front of the courthouse.
Red Shoes is involved.
But
the event itself, go ahead, tell us about the particulars of it.
Sure. So we'll all be meeting at two different times. People can participate. First at noon. So if you want to grab lunch and come meet us, and then also from 4 to 6 in North Boulevard Town Square, which is at the third block of North Boulevard in front of the courthouse. There'll be dancing. There'll be music. And, of course, we'll be handing out our Valentine's Day message, which this year is going to be love equals respect.
That's North Boulevard, noon and 4 to 6 p.m. Rachel Hebert will be there along with others who are involved with her organization and other organizations.
Absolutely.
This is something that people from all over the community will participate in.
That's correct.
How long have you been doing this, Rachel?
I've been at STAR for 5 years now.
5 years. I would think that it at times is a difficult job.
Absolutely. It's definitely challenging to see trauma every day.
But do you think that the people who have come to you on the whole have benefited from coming to your organization for assistance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, silence is violence. And when people come forward and share their story, and it starts to heal.
Silence is violence, and the 1 billion rising, billion with a B, is named because of the estimated 1 billion women who are victims of either some kind of violence or sexual assault. And you said a startling statistic that I think is worthy of repeating, that 3 women a day are mm-hmm. raped in Baton Rouge mm-hmm. in this community. And last year there were only 100 rapes reported in our community.
That's right.
Silence is violence. Your hotline again, 383-7273. Is that correct? 383-7273. We thank you, Rachel Hebert, who will be tomorrow Town Square with the 1 Billion Rising event at noon, and then at 4 o'clock from 4 to 6 p.m. there will be a continuation of this event. We'll be back tomorrow.
Thank you, Jim.
Stay tuned. Thank you.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.